Major funding for the series is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from PRI, Public Radio International.
This is Crossing East. Our stories, our history, our America.
America represented opportunities, economic opportunities for them.
Oregon really was the last frontier.
They signed with their thumbprints that say that they are going to work 4 years as a prostitute for this person who owned them.
I think for a lot of Iseis, it's almost like farming is like part of our heritage as Japanese Americans.
There are 8 unmarked graves here with no record of them. And the fact that there is no record of a name or anything, perhaps they were Chinese.
I'm George Takei. When we return, Frontier Asians on Crossing East.
I'm Dime Roberts with a Crossing East music feature. Every year, Wilma Pang organizes the performances for the Moon Festival in San Francisco. She also helps get Chinese artists onto the street to perform in Chinatown, like this group, the Cantonese Folk Music Society of San Francisco.
I engage, you know, pay for the lion dancers to perform every evening to drum up people to come back to Chinatown. At the same time, I organize the musicians to perform in a particular spot. And the musicians, they chose to play in front of the Golden Dragon because they like the spot, and also the owner or the manager, Golden Dragon, he really like them to be there.
Wilma Pang teaches music at City College of San Francisco and works to preserve Cantonese folk and opera music, something she says is giving way to pop music, even in Asia.
This it's called Yong Chui He now. Da di da 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 da. Da 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 di da 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 di da di da di. Fen fei man lei. This is very Cantonese opera tune, so it is still very popular. It's a separate category from the music nowadays you hear. It's more like, I wouldn't say Michael Jackson, but pop songs.
When the composer Puccini was in New York City opening Madame Butterfly, he heard this Chinese folk song about a beautiful jasmine flower.
That's probably the version Puccini heard. And so Italian, it goes from Chinese folk song, jump to Italian. So this, they talk, Brigitte Nielsen came out and sing this music. It became Italian, you know, based on this song. Throughout Turandot, you hear this tune over and over. It's the theme song of Turandot.
Pang says after 9/11, Asian Americans wanted to show their patriotism, so she got requests to sing the Star Spangled Banner on Chinese radio stations.
First time, you know, heard an Asian American singing the Star Spangled Banner, and I got requested, you know, a request to do a CD, to do American patriotic song. And I've been known to sing the Star Spangled Banner very well. As a matter of fact, the 49ers put out audition a couple of months ago, and I submitted my application. Out of 700 applied, I was one of the 30 finalists to sing the Star Spangled Banner.
Wilma Pang will soon be singing in China. Their song request, I Left My Heart in San Francisco.
When I go to Shanghai, I got requests to sing I Left My Heart in San Francisco in Victorian costume. So anyway, whatever, you know. I can do it in Chinese, because years ago, before George Corey passed away, he's the composer of this tune, he asked me to translate into Chinese, and I did sing in Chinese, talking about 20, 30 years ago. But, you know, I have forgotten how I sang it, but, you know, and I'm trying to refresh my memory before I go to Shanghai, and then I'll sing it, you know, in Chinese and English.
This Crossing East music feature was funded by the National Endowment for the Arts. For more info, go to crossingeast.org. I'm Dee Mae Roberts.
I'm George Takei, your host for Crossing East, our stories, our history, our America. Frontier Asians, Chapter 1, Gold Mountain. 19th century China, widespread poverty and political chaos after the Opium Wars and the aftermath of the peasant rebellions. First, Chinese men were lured or forced to become contract laborers in faraway lands. Then word spread of Gumsan, Gold Mountain. There were riches to be had working the mines of the American West. Villagers pooled their money to send sons, brothers, husbands to get rich and send money home. From the Shasta Courier newspaper, December 3rd, 1853.
3 years ago, it was a matter of no little curiosity to the American miner to see a real live representative of the Celestial Empire with his wooden shoes, his prodigious hat of fantastical proportions, his shaven head, his long black queue dangling to his feet, his light springy pole poised upon his shoulder and freighted with provisions and mining tools as he wended his way to the mines. Thousands of these sable sons of Asia have crossed the Pacific, poured into our towns, and are now swarming in quest of gold through every part of the mines.
At first, it was a free-for-all. Gold fields opened up everywhere in the West and Alaska. Chinese men took over mines abandoned by white miners.
America represented opportunities, economic opportunities for them.
Ronald Takaki, professor of ethnic studies at the University of California, Berkeley.
But they wanted to settle here, and 50% or more of them who came here were already married, and so they had left wives behind. America did not want these Chinese workers to bring wives and children with them and to settle in America. Essentially, they saw the Chinese as temporary workers.
When the gold mining ran out, American businessmen found other uses for these hardworking men.
But what was the American West for Chinese immigrants? It was the gold rush, California. It was also building the railroad. The superintendent of the Central Pacific Railroad, which had a workforce that was 90% Chinese, the superintendent, Charles Crocker, in testimony before Congress said, "We want these men to come over here, work for the railroad temporarily, and then return to China." He said, "We don't want them bringing their wives over here, settling in America and becoming thick," and he used that word, thick. Essentially, there was this view, powerful view, a pervasive view, that the United States should be a white man's country. And so the Chinese were welcomed as workers, but not welcomed as settlers.
Chinese men built the western half of the Transcontinental Railroad.
In spite of this contribution, these immigrants faced discrimination and violence throughout the frontier. In 1885, a mob of white coal miners killed 28 of their Chinese co-workers in Rock Springs, Wyoming, and burned down 79 Chinese homes, causing hundreds of Chinese residents to flee. In 1887, in the Snake River Massacre, 30 Chinese miners were murdered near the Oregon-Idaho border. Chinese immigrants were only welcome as long as their labor was needed. After the American Civil War, widespread economic depression forced many to the West to find work. Chinese workers were becoming more and more unwelcome. But in the dry sagebrush hills of eastern Oregon, in the small town of John Day, a thriving Chinatown emerged, thanks in large part to a doctor named Ing Hay. He was a herbalist and acupuncturist who became known as Doc Hay. His medical practice was located in a general store named the Kamwa Chung. Chapter 2 of Frontier Asians, Doc Hay, Frontier Herbalist, by D. May Roberts.
It was after the railroad had been built, after the Civil War is over. It's the beginning of not only anti-Chinese sentiment, but anti-Chinese violence and then anti-Chinese laws.
But because Oregon was still a frontier, Chinese labor was welcome.
This is where Doc Hay would come and fix your herbs and medicines.
They carried this lady into the house because she couldn't walk and took him back to the treatment room and worked for, I think, maybe about an hour. And doggone if this lady didn't walk out of there.
The story of Ing Doc Hay is full of medical miracles. This Chinese herbalist was the closest thing to a doctor on the eastern Oregon frontier.
Doctor, sir, you have been recommended as a first-class doctor, and as there is no doctor here that can do me any good, I would like to know what you think about my case.
Ing Hay would then prescribe packets of herbs and dictate instructions for his business partner, Lung On, to write in English. In 1882, two young immigrants from China came to the dry sagebrush hills of eastern Oregon at the end of the gold rush. Ing Hay was a doctor of acupuncture and an herbalist. His friend and partner, Lung On, was an educated businessman with a penchant for wheeling and dealing. 5 years after they arrived, they bought a general store and began curing patients near and far. Their story is not well known, but the Kamwa Chung building with its dark, smoke-stained interior and distinct odor of herbal remedies still stands today as a museum.
We do know that opium smoking was done in the building because it was legal till 1909.
Ing Hay came from the Guangdong province of China, where the British Opium Wars and repeated agricultural failures contributed to another rebellion during the 1860s, in which as many as 30 million Chinese died. Many of those who escaped death and poverty came to America during the gold rush.
You really have to go back to the events of the late gold rush.
Jeffrey Barlow, professor of history at Pacific University.
Once gold was discovered, then that began bringing in a great many Chinese workers. There was a period in the 19th century, as strange as it may seem, when Chinese were actually the dominant ethnic group in both Idaho and eastern Oregon.
But after the Civil War and the economic depression that followed, there was a strong anti-Chinese sentiment and anti-Chinese laws throughout the West, leading to the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. The act was in effect till 1943, when China became an ally to America during World War II. Newspapers of the time depicted Chinese people in highly negative images. They were the Yellow Peril, a threat to white America and the labor unions. This led to the passing of many exclusionary laws. But once immigration was almost stopped, some people began to see the remaining Chinese as an endangered asset. An article from the Grant County News of December 1888.
Stockmen say that since the Chinese exclusion bill became a law, Chinamen are scarce, and therefore warn all parties not to kill Mongolians in their employ, or they will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law.
Now, the reason they had all filtered down to John Day as a community was that other communities had become very violent.
Jeffrey Barlow.
Oregon really was the last frontier. By this period, the great cattle drives are over, Texas is being settled, a Mexican-American war has been fought out. Other areas of the country are relatively settled, but Oregon was still very wild. It had its own Western culture. We don't speak of cowboys. Our cowboys are buckaroos. And there was, in that part of eastern Oregon with the gold rush, it was still an extremely violent area.
From 1880 to 1900, there were about 10,000 Chinese residents in Oregon. Most were miners. The rest were ranch hands and laborers.
But because Oregon was still a frontier, Chinese labor was welcome. Labor unions in this period were sort of adopting the American ethnic flag, white ethnicity, as a means of building support. But the mayor simply locked these people up. There was going to be no nonsense in Oregon of this kind of racial violence. And that was because the area was an underpopulated frontier, and we were much more concerned about having the labor available than we were taking a look at the color of the men and women who were doing it. On the frontier, race is a lot less important than you might think. I think race is more important in the towns and cities than it is out in the countryside or on the ranches. What we found was the main concern of the people in this area was really an answer to one simple question: can you do your job? Can you be relied upon? Are you a man or a woman who will stick? And the Chinese were, so this was the work that they wound up doing, and in John Day, they were welcome.
Gum wa chung, gum gold wa blossom chung, prosperity. Gum wa chung.
The Kam Wa Chung building was closed down in 1955. The building, with much of its contents intact, was forgotten for more than two decades. In the 1970s, John Day officials trying to buy land nearby discovered that the city owned it. Jeffrey Barlow and Christine Richardson were the first scholars to help piece together the puzzle of Ing Doc Hay's life.
Doc Hay was so valuable to the community that he was protected. So this is a man who was, to begin with, 19th century Chinese, which means not very tall, not very heavy. But if you can imagine a small, slight Chinese man who never really learned to speak English, Long An had to interpret for him. His English was broken at best. It wasn't among his many talents. Living in that violent environment, the poor man, we have no evidence that he was frightened. I think he probably trusted in the spirits that he probably saw as protecting him in the area, but I would have been frightened. Most of us would have been frightened in that particular environment. And he lived in a building in the Kam Wa Chung after 1887 that had to serve as a kind of a fortification, because periodically buckaroos would get liquored up and go down and decide they were going to hoorah the Chinamen. So they would lock the shutters and stay.
Our front door, as you can see, was well locked, as well as a wooden bolt in it went across and the lock. It also was lined with metal, and our whole building is stone on the outside, as well as the doors were metal. These are heavy doors.
A small two-story house, the Kam Wa Chung stands dark and claustrophobic. The floorboards creak and the walls are black from smoke. Carolyn Meisenheimer has been curator of the Kam Wa Chung and Company Museum for almost 30 years.
We do have one bullet hole in the door. They say the Americans would shoot up Chinatown once in a while on Saturday night and have not a malicious time, but have a scaring time for the Chinese.
Part two of Doc Hay, Frontier Herbalist, when we come back. This segment of Crossing East is brought to you by the Portland Chinese Classical Garden, a Ming Dynasty scholar's garden in Portland, Oregon.
Actors featured in this segment of Frontier Asians were Andre Alcala, Sam A. Mowry, Chung So, and Jim Chan. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm George Takei, and you're listening to Crossing East. Now, part two of Doc Hay, Frontier Herbalist.
Gum wa cheng, gum gold, wa blossom cheng, prosperity. Gum wa cheng.
Lung On, Doc Hay's business partner, was the educated businessman and operated the general store. He sold bootleg whiskey during Prohibition and the first cars in eastern Oregon at the turn of the century. He was also an avid gambler and sold opium in the back room till it became illegal.
They did cook on the wood stove. Doc Hay, when he first started using his medicines, he cooked your herbs up for you and gave you the liquid, and then he started giving you the herbs and you did the cooking at home.
There's still a strong herbal smell in the Camwacheng. Ing Hay, a master of Chinese medicine, was sought out by people on the frontier where there were no hospital facilities or qualified doctors. He would often take patients when Western medicine had failed. Doc Hay offered hope to the desperate.
There's a tumor on the left side of my neck. Yeah, I would be so glad if you would reduce that, as the doctors are wanting to cut it out and I have such a dread of the knife.
He was a pulse doctor. He would not pick up anything with his right hand at all. He used his left hand. His right hand was his diagnosis hand, so that he would lay those fingers on your wrist and other pulses to read the internal state of your body.
Doctor, sir, I will tell you how I am, and then if you can cure me, I will come out there, or you can send me medicine through the mail.
They would prescribe by mail. There are many letters from people who had been in the area and had moved out or had heard of Doc Hay in one way or another, and they would write in, explain. Sometimes Lung An, we think, wrote back and asked a few more questions, and then Doc Hay sent herbs. Many of their recipes are takeout, if you will, a little sack with Lung An's careful handwriting telling you how to put these recipes together on your own stove.
Among the artifacts from the Camwacheng are pages and pages of prescriptions written in Chinese.
金狗二钱，加多银花三钱，当归一钱半。
This is where Doc Hay would come and fix your herbs and medicines. He had 500 different Chinese herbs on the shelf. We do know what 250 of the 500 are used for. Most of them would be in a form of a tea. You would get so many and boil it up and make your tea and then drink your tea according to his directions. Or you might have gotten some kind of animal parts, deer horns, turtle shell, might have been ground up into powder and put in your medicine. And some of them, the tins are a square tin. They made the tins out of different things. And then you could have most any kind of thing.
I understand that there were some, I don't know whether it was prejudice or just some problems with the medical profession. They didn't like his practicing medicine and they tried to shut him down, but there were enough resident supporters that they knocked it down every time they brought it to court, and they never were able to get anything with that.
Ed Waugh, the grandnephew of Ing Doc Hay, moved to John Day, Oregon in 1942 when he was in elementary school.
When we arrived, of course, he was blind and he was alone. He had just lost his business partner, Lung An. And Dad, being a relative, felt obligated to go there and take care of him. And knowing some herbs from China, he very quickly took up the practice that Doc Hay had there. And with Doc Hay's expertise and his knowledge in reading Chinese, he read all the herbal books. And so he gradually took over Doc Hay's practice. And we took care of Doc Hay for several years there while he lived in John Day. But my remembrance of Doc Hay was, although he was blind, he knew everybody that came in. He would recognize their voice and just, yes. He just identified the people just immediately.
His parents slept in the kitchen. He and his brother took the bunk beds that once were reserved for opium smoking.
Every time we sit down for dinner, instead of having a tablecloth, he'd just spread some newspaper, and that was a tablecloth. Then he'd have his pot of tea there always, of course, when people come in, they were offered a cup of tea and sit and visit a while.
Sometimes people would come to buy groceries, sometimes to pray at the Buddhist shrines Inghe had built, but usually it was the doctor they wanted to see.
He was the source of last resort, and oftentimes they were pleasantly surprised with cures. One winter afternoon, a party came in from Burns, Oregon. They carried this lady into the house because she couldn't walk and took him back to the treatment room and worked for, I think, maybe about an hour. And doggone if this lady didn't walk out of there. And I was so impressed with that. I said, well, what did he do, you know? It was a complication of the flu or something like that that affected her nervous system. And that kind of results, immediate results, is hard to find anywhere else.
This was Doc Hay's bedroom. Actually, it was under this bed that they found the $23,000 worth of uncashed checks. And it was under that bed, of course, all those checks were found.
Part of the income was Doc Hay, for sure. I think, in a sense, their social network and protection was Doc Hay, because Hay was so valuable on the frontier as a doctor that nobody was going to permit anyone from outside to come in and shoot their China doctor full of holes. He was too valuable a guy. So for Lung An, being next to Doc Hay meant that he was safe. On the other hand, for Doc Hay, Lung An meant here is a man who can communicate, who can write, who can communicate with China, where the herbs came from, who knows how to invest money, who knows how to manipulate social organization of both the Chinese and the Americans. And they were simply a wonderful partnership.
I remember I was scared to death of the Chinese people because I'd never been around them.
Thelma Kite was 4 years old when her mom took her to Inghe for an ear infection.
The doctor would give me candy to try to get me over it, but I'd hide behind my mother's skirt and reach around to take the candy because I was, like I say, I was scared. But I remember being teased by relatives about the Chinese doctor giving me kisses, which was the candy kisses.
Inghe and Lung An never went back to China. The Exclusion Act of 1882 created a society of Chinese bachelors who can neither bring their wives here nor go home to their wives without risking deportation. Inghe and Lung An settled into their American life on the frontier. In 1887, the Chinatown in John Day was a thriving, independent community of 1,000. By 1940, fewer than 20 residents of Chinese descent lived in John Day. Ed Hua and his family stayed with Inghe till he could no longer walk.
And he loved his cigars, and he had a big soft chair in the front room there, and he'd sit there and smoke his cigar and fall asleep. But unfortunately, he fell and broke his hip, and that was his downfall. We had to bring him into Portland then and put him into a rest home where they could take care of him because he's just too much for Dad and Mom to take care of. And I think he lived there for 2-3 years, and then he just decided there's nothing to live for. So then he passed on.
Ing Doc Hay died in 1952. He and Lung An were so respected as community members, they are the only frontier Chinese in Grant County, Oregon, with actual markers on their graves.
We're here at Rest Lawn Cemetery, and actually it's in the city limits. I feel like Doc Hay and Lung An are old friends. Lung An died in 1940, he born in 1863. Then Doc Hay died in 1952, and he was born in 1862.
Carolyn Meisenheimer personally saw to it that the graves were restored. Their tombstones stand beside the graves of Ed Hua's parents.
As far as I know, this is the only two recognized or four recognized graves Chinese in Grant County. There are 8 unmarked graves here with no record of them. And part of it is when I talk to people about them, they think the fact that there is no record of a name or anything, perhaps they were Chinese.
Yao Wai Gok Han Samwa.
frontier is lined with the unmarked graves of Chinese who helped to mine gold or build railroads. The Kamwa Chung and the story of Ying He and Lung An stands as one of the rare testaments to the contribution Chinese immigrants made to early frontier life.
The important lesson then is to see these people as individuals. Now, we can see their lives as tragic. There are times when I think of Lung An and Doc Hay sitting in that dark Kamwa Chung building, kerosene lighting, until well into the 1940s. We can see them as sort of the isolated, dying remnants of Chinese culture, if we wish, and that's sad. But on the other hand, we have to see their lives against the options that were available to them in China, and also in terms of the images that they created for themselves. They became Ying He and Lung An. Who were they when they were home alone talking to each other? I really don't know. I see them as men who came out of a terribly difficult environment into another equally challenging environment and totally mastered it. And for me, it's hard to see them as anything other than incredibly successful. In a quiet way, kind of heroes, not kind of stand up and shoot it out heroism, but a heroism that comes to learn a foreign culture and a language and adapt to foreign ways. I don't see them as victims at all.
Hey, 快快脆脆啦, 又不要阻止時間。
The
story of Doc Hay, Frontier Herbalist by Dime Roberts. Special thanks to the Kamwa Chung and Company Museum and the Oregon Parks Trust. This story was produced with funding by the Oregon Council for the Humanities and the Regional Arts and Culture Council. There were few Chinese women among the early wave of Chinese immigrants to this country. Chinese women were discouraged from joining their men in America by cultural restrictions against women traveling abroad, by the lack of traveling funds and jobs for them in America, and by U.S. immigration policies. The Page Act of 1875, which sought to stop the trafficking of Chinese prostitutes, placed harsh restrictions on any woman entering the country. And the Chinese Exclusion Act specifically barred the immigration of Chinese laborers, and by implication, their wives. The laws and the lonely situation of Chinese men became a reason for underground organizations to import Chinese women as prostitutes. What little we know about these women comes from the records of Protestant mission homes set up to rescue and house Chinese prostitutes and abused slave girls. Some of the women themselves wrote letters to family. We begin with the story of Wang Ah So, Chapter 3, Frontier Women.
I was born in Guangdong Province. My father was sometimes a sailor, and sometimes he worked on the docks, for we were very poor. I was 19 when this man came to see my mother and said that in America there was a good deal of gold. Even if I just peeled potatoes there, he told my mother, I would earn $7 or $8 a day. I thought that I was his wife and was very grateful when he was taking me to such a grand free country, where everyone was rich and happy.
When I talk about the immigration of Chinese women in the 19th century, most women stayed behind in China to take care of the families, and their husbands couldn't afford to bring them here. But there was one group of women that dominated and that were brought here for their labor. And this would be Chinese women who were brought here to work as prostitutes.
When we first landed in San Francisco, we lived in a hotel in Chinatown. A nice place. But one day, after I had been there for about 2 weeks, a woman came to see me. She told me that I was not really Huey Yao's wife, but that she had asked him to buy her a slave, that I belonged to her.
They were women who had been sold by their poor families in China, sometimes were misled into thinking they were coming to marry someone, or be put to work at some respectable job.
February 7, 1924. To my honorable mother, greetings. I hope you are well and so my heart will be at peace. Your daughter has come to America. Your daughter's condition is very tragic. Even when she is sick, she must practice prostitution. Daughter is not angry with you. It seems to be just my fate.
They had these contracts that they signed with their thumbprints that say that they are going to work 4 years as a prostitute for this person who owned them. And it also said that if they became sick or they couldn't perform, they would have to extend their contracts.
Since I have not done evil to others, why should others do evil to me? At home, a daughter should be obedient to her parents. After marriage, to her husband. After the death of her husband, to her son. These are the three great obediences.
For Chinese men, not only were there not Chinese women here, but they also had laws that forbid interracial marriage between Chinese and whites. It creates a situation where there are criminal tongs, secret societies set up so that they could bring these girls who had been sold by their parents to the United States, and the women were literally sold into prostitution.
I was in that life for 7 months, and then I was released. It was at a party given by the Tong men, where slave girls are invited. Suddenly, I saw a friend of my father's come in, a man who had seen me less than a year ago. Although I was all dressed up so grand, he recognized me. And the first chance he had, he came and asked me, "Are you not so-and-so's daughter?" So I told him all.
The missionaries made it a point to publicize all the good work. And this was their way of saying that they were trying to help eradicate prostitution, and they would give very detailed accounts of these rescue raids that they did with the help of law officers.
About 10 days after the party and the interview with these men, I was rescued and taken to the mission. I am learning English and to weave, and I am going to send money to my mother when I can. I can't help but cry, but it is going to be better.
Some of the women tried to run away with the help of men who befriended them or who loved them. The only other way, and some of the women did this, was to commit suicide rather than continue to work and endure these conditions as a sex slave.
As in the building of a house, there are 12 beams and you do not know which is the strongest. So in a family, you cannot judge which will be the most dependable one. A son is a human being, so is a daughter. At home, everybody looks down upon the daughter. How is it now? Since daughter came to California, by right, she should forsake you. But in thinking it over, the greatest virtue in life is reverence to parents. So I am keeping a filial heart.
In a moment, we'll hear the story of Polly Bemis, a Chinese woman in the rural West. In part one of Frontier Women, you heard Judy Young, author of Unbound Voices, with Elaine Lowe as Wanga So. This is Crossing East. This segment of Crossing East is brought to you by the Portland Chinese Classical Garden, a cultural heritage destination at portlandchinesegarden.com.
You're listening to PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you. I'm George Takei, and this is Crossing East, Frontier Asians. Most Chinese men in the American West lived as bachelors, unable to bring their wives and families due to exclusionary laws against Asian immigration. Some Chinese women were trafficked into the country and forced to work as indentured prostitutes. Living and working under horrid and brutal conditions, many did not outlive the 4 years of service specified in their contracts. But some escaped and made better lives for themselves on the frontier. Part 2 of Frontier Women, Polly Bemis.
Polly Bemis was sold for 2 bags of seed to bandits by her family during a time of famine. And she was brought here and auctioned off in San Francisco.
1,000 Pieces of Gold tells the story of Polly Bemis, starting from when she was Leluna Thoi, born in northern China, and sold by her family to bandits, and then brought to America and auctioned off as a slave, taken up to the mining camps of Idaho, winning her freedom through a poker game, and then ending up with her husband on the River of No Return.
Through a gray haze of cigar smoke, she looked down at the men crowded into the saloon. Bearded demon miners in faded flannel shirts and worn corduroy pants stuffed into heavy, mud-caked boots. Smooth-faced Chinese in traditional blue cotton jackets and pants, or full-sleeved, long-tailed Chinese shirts hanging out over coarse demon trousers. They were all the same, hungry. Like the coyotes she heard howling in the night, and she was their prey.
Warren's, Idaho at that time was a mining camp. There were probably a dozen white women to 1,000 white men and another 1,000 Chinese men. And Lulu was the only Chinese woman. She was brought to Warren's for, quote-unquote, the world's oldest profession, but she was saved from it by Charlie Bemis. I think she and Charlie had a very loving relationship. In 1890, Charlie was shot, and it shattered his cheekbone. And Polly took her crochet hook and fished out the fragments.
She worked silently. The crochet hook sank deeper and deeper, but she could not find the bullet. Bits of flesh and splintered bone gleamed whitely on cotton swabs blackened with powder and blood. She packed it with a poultice of herbs and fresh cloths. "Polly's here," she soothed. "You okay?" She cradled him in her arms. He quieted. Dusk deepened into night.
After she married, she and Charlie moved to the Salmon River. People were drawn by her warm hospitality. She was a great cook. You know, we know that she came to consider that home.
In addition to fruits and vegetables, she grew her own wheat and ground her own flour to make bread. The single cow and hens provided all their dairy needs, and she rendered her own grease and made soap from the occasional bear Charlie shot. During the spring, summer, and fall, there were only the occasional prospectors and adventurers Charlie ferried across the river. But in the winter, when the river froze over with huge chunks of ice, ranchers and old friends from Warren's would come. They would stay up all night, getting caught up on news, retelling old stories, playing poker, eating, and drinking whiskey made from her own rye and hops. Then Charlie would bring out his fiddle, and there would be singing and sometimes dancing, and for days their snug, two-storied log cabin would fairly shake from all the laughter and foot stomping.
She and Charlie actually found a cougar cub, and she treated it like a family cat. And she nailed a tin plate on the table so that the cougar could eat when they ate. And visitors were terrified of the cougar. and she was the only person who could handle it. There are a lot of strong women, but she actually survived without being bitter and with her sense of compassion intact.
These women were in some ways the lifeline for supporting their families because they were sewed so that their families can survive. And they sent money home when they could. They have made a contribution to their families and to their communities and to this country that, you know, most people would not be willing to acknowledge.
Birdsong woke Polly. She had arrived too late the night before to see anything more than deep shadows and starlight, but the warm embrace of the canyon walls and the welcoming roar of the salmon had told her she was home.
Frontier Women by Sarah Caswell Colbert. Part 2 included Judy Young, author of Unbound Voices, Ruth Ann Lum McCunn, and passages from her book about Polly Bemis, A Thousand Pieces of Gold, with Chisao Hata reading the story of Polly Bemis.
I'm Harold Tamano. We're standing behind my house. We're looking at my field, which is 100 acres along the Sacramento River, north of West Sacramento.
Asians have farmed in California for more than 100 years. The Chinese worked in the fields as well as mining gold and building railroads. And when the first wave of anti-Asian sentiments expelled the Chinese, Japanese immigrants took up their places in the fields. They eventually found opportunities to work for themselves, buying up small plots of land to establish family farms. But internment, the forced removal of Japanese and Japanese Americans to camps during World War II, separated many families from their land. Only some of those properties, like that of Harold Tamano's family, survived until their owners returned. Our final chapter of Crossing East, Farming Roots.
My father, Kiyoshi Tamano, was farming before me, grandfather before him. My father worked as a laborer and then started his own farm. I'm sure that they must have had just a bare subsistence level initially, but in the 60s and 70s he did fairly well. By the time he was doing fairly well is when I came along and kind of got into the business.
Tamano's grandfather immigrated to the West Coast in the early 1900s and used his farming background to become part of the growing agricultural economy.
The West Coast essentially was an agricultural economy, which is different from the East Coast of the United States. You know, it was industrializing, and so that's where the opportunities were for the Japanese.
Wayne Maeda is senior lecturer in ethnic studies at Sacramento State.
And essentially, they came to the right country at the right time. The Chinese had established agriculture in California. Japanese filled the cheap labor slot. The railroads had been built, refrigeration cars. So those were all important things that allowed the Japanese to get into farming and stay in farming. So they began to devise a number of ways, leasing land, sharecropping, and then ultimately they were able to save money to begin to purchase small plots of land, 20, 25, 30 acres.
The small size of their farms dictated the types of crops that could be profitable, says Professor Isao Fujimoto of the University of California, Davis.
And so the selection of crops like corn, wheat, completely out. But if you had 3 or 4 acres of strawberries or even a half acre of flower growing in a greenhouse, that increases your opportunity for income. So that has a lot to do with the kind of intense concentration, but also a very selective kind of attention to rethinking about what the good market is.
Like my grandfather brought over a little more attention to detail, not trying to farm so much as taking care of what he grew.
As they were coming in to replace the Chinese laborers, they became the model minority. It was argued that they brought families and they worked hard and they weren't like the Chinese. And that sentiment lasted a very short time. And people in California began to argue that if the trend continues, Japan and the Japanese will take over California. So you had any number of discriminatory kinds of things, the Alien Land Act of 1913, another one in 1920. They were declared ineligible for citizenship. So they were coming into America that had just gotten rid of the Chinese. And so they took on the sentiment of the anti-Asiatic feelings in California.
Later, Filipino, Punjabi, Korean, and Mexican laborers began to take over from the Japanese, just as the Japanese had taken over from the Chinese decades before. It's a recurring pattern in California agriculture.
I'm Harry Masaru Yokoyama, 88 years old, and I'm a former vegetable farmer, and my specialty was raising green onions and spinach. My folks were strawberry growers, and then they changed to vegetables, and then I took up the occupation. At that time, my father was weak, and then he was a small man, and he was getting sickly, so finally, my high school education was broken up because I had to go home and help. So I sort of got interested in farming at the time. I didn't have much money. My father never gave me a penny, but he always was used to tell us, you got to buy land, you got to buy land.
Isao Fujimoto.
Very difficult to get money. You need money to do anything. So the Japanese started their own what we call rotating credit associations. And this is called tanomoshi in Japanese. Well, many immigrants don't have collateral. They don't have land. They don't have anything to put up. So the main collateral they used was personal honor. And honor was very valuable because if you renege, you'd be ostracized by the group. This is another strategy to use if you are putting up a lot of discrimination.
I think for many of the farms who were able to survive the Depression, they were on the verge of doing quite well. And I think had the Japanese farmers not been interned, they would have profited from World War II, just like many of them did quite well during World War I, growing beans and other things for the military.
Professor Maeda is talking about Executive Order 9066, which was issued by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt after the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor. It unjustly ordered the removal of all Japanese Americans from the West Coast and their detainment in 10 concentration camps in desolate areas of the United States for the duration of World War II.
There was a shortage of labor, farm labor everywhere. And many places were letting kids out of high school early and all. And so I remember in the Heart Mountain camp, all the young people were called to harvest sugar beets. And so this is how my grandfather and my aunt, they were able to leave camp on what they call temporary leave. They had to come back to the concentration camp. But they were allowed to go out for 2 or 3 months to help out farms in Idaho, Montana, and so on.
We were doing real good, but then the war came, and then we had to shut down. My father, one of the Portuguese landowners there, said that in his pasture, why don't you build a warehouse and keep all your stuff there instead of selling it. So that's what we did. But when we came back from camp, everything was stolen. So some heavy equipment we were able to salvage. And I bought a tractor for $500 and a small tractor, wheel tractor, and I got started that way. And as we went along, we kept adding the equipment. But it was a slow start, but I got started.
Established farmers who returned to their land often had to start over from scratch. Harold Tamano's father had only begun farming in the 1930s, so his losses weren't large. After the war, he became successful. Harold Tamano.
Basically, after I took over, I had to change the way that we did everything. Because when you expand, it just costs you a lot more. But then you think you're going to make more, and initially you do. I mean, you do. I mean, it should work out that way. It's just, like I said, the whole industry really changed. You know, unless you, again, it had to be a specialty item. And if you could hit on it at the right time and get big enough volume from it, then you're doing okay. Otherwise, you just had to expand with the times. And that was too much effort, too much risk.
Almost everything I got's for sale. I don't know what I'm going to do with some of this equipment. The old tractors, siphons.
I would say great proportion of people are no longer in farming. There's a tremendous number of people, Japanese American third generation, who are in different kind of professional work. And so there's been a big shift intergenerationally. Of those who stayed in farming, though, the major kind of shift I see is that the economy has had its big role in terms of weeding people out. So the people who survive now have to get big.
My one regret, if you want to, my biggest regret is that this is, I'm the third generation, and there's not going to be any more. There's no opportunity to be anymore. I think for a lot of Iseis, farming was the only opportunity given to them. To me, it's almost like farming is like part of our heritage as Japanese Americans.
Today, yet another wave of Asian immigrants takes its place in the fields of California. Isao Fujimoto.
Many Japanese have left farming, and yet people are still producing strawberries on a small scale, as an example. And who's doing the work? It's the refugees from Southeast Asia. There must be at least 800 families from Laos, either Hmong or Laotians, who are doing the farming. And the farming is really 2 to 5 acre strawberry farms.
First-generation farmers like Harry Yokoyama wait for a good offer on their idle farmland.
The houses are right up to there now. That's going to be valuable. So I'm old, so, you know, whatever the kids decide to do, that's up to them. Yeah, they get everything, so it's the story of my life.
Farming Roots by Rangita Young Giesler. We came in many waves, across oceans, across lands. We labored in the gold mines, blasting railroad tunnels, making rich the soil of dry land. We came always in search of the dream. This is Crossing East, our stories, our history, our America. I'm George Takei.
Crossing East is produced with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Paul G. Allen Family Foundation, the Spirit Mountain Community Fund, the National Endowment for the Arts, and individual donors of Media Rights Productions. Music was provided by the Cantonese Folk Music Society of San Francisco. Our theme music is by Shasta Tycho from their CD, Spirit Drum. The managing editor is Catherine Stifter. The associate producer is Sarah Caswell Colbert. The Crossing East engineer is Clark Salisbury, with technical assistance by Michael Johnson. The marketing and outreach director is Ping Ka. The executive producer is D-May Roberts. To find out more about Crossing East and this program, go to crossingeast.org. Support for Crossing East comes from this station and Public Radio International stations and is made possible in part by the PRI Series Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Yow, why, go, han, samua, gang,
PRI, Public Radio International.